It was in the documentary called Who the Bleep is Jackson Pollock that Peter Paul Biro first became famous, or whatever the equivalent of fame is with people who watch documentaries and know a little about art. So, NPR fame. In this same film, Thomas Hoving played the role television and movies has trained us to loathe, the pompous aesthete who, here, dismisses with a haughty glance a supposed masterpiece. But like any villain in American cinema, Hoving gets his comeuppance from a plucky, raspy, School of Hard Knocks Westerner and the fastidious forensic scientist who takes her part. That scientist is Biro, who almost miraculously finds a Pollock fingerprint on the painting in question and matches it to one in Pollock's studio, thereby rendering Thomas Hoving's effete connoisseurship null in the face of undeniable science. Hooray, science! Boo, art establishment. But, as we never find out in the film, our scientist hero Biro made something of a cottage industry of finding Pollock fingerprints on otherwise unattributed paintings. Some of these, despite his findings, were later proven not to be Pollock works at all. This information comes to us from a New Yorker article written by David Gran in 2010. We also learn in the article that it wasn't just abstract expressionist works that were lousy with their artist fingerprints, but masterpieces all the way from Leonardo da Vinci to J.M.W. Turner. Biro was finding fingerprints everywhere and getting a great deal of money in the bargain. For instance, in the late 1990s, Biro discovered a work in a Boston antique store that ultimately proved to have the, you guessed it, fingerprint of a Raphael disciple. Even more than that, Biro claimed to have discovered a hidden compartment in the frame of the work that contained a note supposedly signed by Raphael the day before he died. Biro extracted more than $1 million from a Canadian financier in an ultimately fruitless effort to sell the painting as authentic. Alas, the note was proven not to have come from the 16th century at all, and the whole thing pronounced by a Renaissance scholar as, quote, a very skilled, elaborate, and expert hoax, unquote. Grand's article also reported that Biro had been in and out of courts in the 80s and 90s on the losing end of cases involving art forgery. It was not the sort of article a man in the authentication business wanted to see, so he sued. At first, the suit was aimed at David Gran and the publisher of The New Yorker, but he recently added other entities, including Gawker Media and the Georgia Museum of Art, for libel arising from the publication or republication of various parts of the story, according to Biro's complaint, quote, through selective omission, innuendo, and malicious sarcasm, the article paints a portrait of plaintiff which has no basis in reality, unquote. Biro asked for not less than $10 million. Biro's complaint, filed by Robert Altman, is almost as entertaining as a New Yorker article. It is certainly more hilarious. For instance, in one paragraph, the attorney calls the New Yorker writer fatuous and unprofessional. In the very next paragraph, this same attorney cites Wikipedia as an authoritative source. In another section, the complaint takes issue with Grand's description of Biro when they met. A chubby man in his 50s, dressed in black pants and turtleneck, cradling a small dog named Coco in his, quote, elegant three-story brick house in Montreal, unquote. Biro complains this makes him appear sinister instead of how it actually makes him appear the opposite of sinister. This is strangely representative of a lot of the passages Biro cites as defamatory. They're not outright falsehoods, but, he claims, characterize him in a way that leaves a negative impression. The word implies comes up a lot in the complaint. Well, who knows? This might be a good strategy. The New Yorker is well known as a magazine that employs assiduous fact checkers. It is not at all known for employing assiduous implication checkers. I'm Travis McDade.